Lemetatans Munya. I'm Alan Hallowell, and this is Indotech. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 9 of the Indotechno Podcast. Now, the world's dominant e-commerce platforms have millions of storefronts on them. Alibaba, for instance, has at least 8.5 million different stores on its marketplace. As one might surmise, the vast majority of these merchants can literally just be mom-and-pop operations, often manned by no more than three or four individuals. These small sellers often encounter challenges early on, whether it's improving their branding and marketing campaign, ensuring that their digital advertising budget is well spent, raising money to grow, or adding headcount to expand the business. Our guest today, TJ Thum, has co-founded one of Indonesia's more successful brand aggregators, Jufu, spelled T-J-U-F-O-O. They're also called roll-up vehicles. These companies acquire and scale these smaller e-commerce businesses. They seek to grow the value of these merchants by addressing the challenges that I just mentioned, in addition to assisting with things like new product development, inventory and supply chain management, logistics, customer experience, going into overseas markets, and other elements to grow top line and or manage costs downward. Thanks so much for joining us today, TJ.
Hey, thanks, Alan, for having me on the show. And what you guys are doing on the podcast has been amazing for the region, giving the exposure that Indonesia and its tech founders really need to access the more global audience. Very honored to be here to speak with you today.
I respond extremely well to such flattery, so this should be a very enjoyable session. Now, TJ, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a humble little town in Malaysia called Subang Jaya. Actually, there are quite a number of tech founders and senior management that I know in the region that come from Subang for some weird reason. But I think Malaysia is a very good place to grow up in. It grounds you very well because it's a good market to test a lot of things, but it's not big enough a market to really scale up a business. So very early on, we have to figure out how to grow a business into a regional one or work overseas to get the experience that will really help us grow a Malaysian business. It's been great growing up here in Malaysia, having shown overseas early on. So I think that combination experience really helps to be a Southeast Asian entrepreneur.
Excellent. In many ways, the many ethnic groups within Malaysia are a mini version of the kind of fractured and very diverse Southeast Asian environment. So that makes eminent sense. Now, the first thing that leaps out from a review of your CV is that you gained your undergraduate degree from Royal Northern College of Music. Tell us about your upbringing and how you ended up, of all places, at RNCM.
I get that question a lot, in a good way, I think, or maybe some people think it's weird. But I think that's the great thing about being in the tech world or today's startup scene. You can be from all different backgrounds, different shapes and sizes, and you still have the opportunity to succeed. And for me, I've always loved music. I think that's at the heart of a lot of things I do. Somewhat like Brian Chesky of Airbnb, he's more of an artist side, not so much of the tech geek, the science and engineering major. It's a bit more, call it right brain and left brain. So I think when I was given the opportunity by my parents to choose a degree that I wanted, which is not very common, right, amongst Asian parents, I would say, like a typical engineer, doctor, or accountant type of degree. So I said, hey, I want to do music because I always had a lot of affinity to it. And when I went to audition in some of the royal schools, I actually got accepted into a couple of them and also got a small little call bursary for it. So it's like, it all made sense. Manchester is a great city to be in with a lot of other students. I didn't want to look back when I was 50 and said, hey, I missed that opportunity. So I thought, let's just do it and see what happens post that.
The Brian Chesky comparison really paints a picture, at least for an American who's familiar with Airbnb. I guess everyone is familiar with Airbnb. I need to ask a follow-up. How, if at all, does what we call this right brain background relate to your work as a tech entrepreneur?
Actually, it relates a lot because a lot of people don't really know what makes up, call it like a music degree. Everyone thinks it's all cool and fun. It does have those moments, but it's a lot of hard work. It's pretty much 996 all the time in the music degree, believe it or not. So we've already been trained to do that kind of hours, like consultants, a lot of the tech firms, one checkbox there. But a music degree in the UK or in Europe is actually viewed as a degree that's a lot more challenging and more recognized than even an engineering degree, because it's a four-year degree, right? It's not a three-year degree. And it also has a combination of theory and practical. So we are actually judged on, call it 60% output performance, very performance driven, and 40% academic. We're given like piece of music to play a week before, and we're supposed to perform it in front of an audience very quickly. And you have to work with random people. So random musicians, you wouldn't know them. With all that, you have to be very good at analyzing scores, like musical scores. You have to do research into the history of the music. Like when you play Mozart and Bach, it's a lot of nuance that you can't miss out. You can't play something a bit off because people criticize you a lot for it. So the analytical ability is something I learned a lot in music, which is also recognizing patterns, because music is a lot of patterns. When I look at data, I look at graphs and charts, it's just pattern recognition sometimes. I see that as how I draw that relation. And second is working with people. I work in orchestras. I follow great conductors, leaders, and you have to work with other musicians overnight, big egos, a lot of them. How do you manage those very quickly? I think building a team instantly is very important, rapport with someone. So I think that helped me in my professional career to work better with people, to really understand them in that first minute when we connect. So two very big things. I think maybe a third smallish one from music would be looking at things in a much broader vision, because, and also connecting the dots, looking backwards, a bit of Steve Jobs analogy, because when you look at music, it's always playing things in the past most of the time, because I do more classical music. So it's looking things in the past, how it connects with the future. I've been very fortunate to see all that history and how it connects with what people do today. And I think that's where, when we look at history, we study economics. So you can draw the dots looking backwards that way, and how it should connect with the users today, the needs today, and how things evolve. So I think that's something that we were forced to do. I hated it most of the time, but it turned out to be very useful in today's world.
Very tempted to splinter off and create a new episode that's really devoted to the trials, tribulations, and rewards of being a musician, but I'm going to stay on script here. Now, tell us about your collective, what I counted to be 8 years at Grab. It looks like you spend much of it involved in and leading their two-wheel business.
Yes, I was very fortunate, to be honest, and it was pure, call it pure luck, that I ended up there. I just want to say a quick thanks to my really good friend, Edwin Fu, who was the first general manager at Grab on my taxi back in the day, who recruited me and believed in me. What happened was, when I came back from the UK after graduating, you know, I was just looking for something to do, and she couldn't find someone to fill the gap. And also a little thanks to those who rejected my taxi in the early days, a little nudge there. But basically, I started off as a launcher back in 2013, where Grab, at that time, we had basically no money. It was just using Anthony Tan's pocket money, call it, right, to launch the business and the hard grant that he got. I was a bit surprised when I went into office. It was really that fairy tale kind of thing. It's cardboard boxes, plastic mamak chairs. In Malaysia, we have a lot of mamaks. So it was a very weird setup, because my good friend Adeline, she came from the consulting world. So very high caliber type of person, and then coming to do this startup. So I was like, okay, weird. But fast forward 10 years later, everyone says, hey, what foresight you guys had? But no, I think we're just stupid lucky, I think, in many ways. So started off as a launcher. I launched Malaysia, most of its cities, and then I was sent to Singapore to launch Singapore after we got our first round of funding from Vertex, and then sent over to Thailand, Vietnam, and then eventually was based full-time in Indonesia in 2016 after Gojek launched its business January that year. And then I had to launch GrabBike, a competitive product to Gojek, in April. Yeah, it's very typical. Anthony would call it and say, hey, you have to launch this new business or this new country, and you had 1 or 2 months to launch it. So that's how it went. And so built that business from zero to probably about maybe close to 2 million daily transactions. It was a $1 billion GMV. Believe it or not, a musician can do it. I think a lot of other people probably can do better things, if you ask me. So yeah, and then from there, I think in 2018, I handed over the two-wheel business, which also consists of GrabFood and GrabExpress, to some other folks in the Indonesian team. And then I took over the electric vehicle business for Grab for the region until early last year when I left after 8-9 years of tenure there.
So let's obviously move on to your current gig. As I mentioned in my introductory remarks, Jufu is what one might call a brand aggregator or e-commerce merchant roll-up play. Can you describe the basics of this business to our audience?
Sure. It's actually a very simple concept, and it's not extremely new, because if you look at private equity roll-ups, M&A consolidation, it's quite similar or goes along those lines, where we, as a company at Jufu, we have a thesis of what categories that we think would be great to invest in. And we would go out there to look for brands, companies that are in those categories. And we would either partner with our equity level, which means a 51% stake and above, into those companies. And we would work together with the partners or the founders and help them to grow the business to the next level. Because I think that today it's very challenging, right, to grow any type of business, especially online. So we put together the team to help these brands grow to the next level and even support the founders to upskill them. And that's one of our social costs as well, because coming from Grab, helping, you know, millions of drivers to upskill, earn a better income, I think it's good to continuously give back to the community. And I think we take a very strong approach to not leaving the founders. We want to keep them on board, help them grow, help them upskill, because a lot of them are quite traditional founders. They don't have professional training. And so that's our homework. We are willing to go through the thick and thin with them and not just leave them because of a dollar, basically.
Understood. I didn't connect what you're doing today to Grab's mission, which is also to support small businesses. In their case, it's more driver-centric. Now, TJ, the company mentions that it wants to, quote-unquote, build the next Unilever-like brands powerhouse for Indonesia. Tell us a little more about that.
Of course, the business that we're building, Jufu, it's been maybe 2 years in the works. So we've been studying a lot of different business models. And I think for us, we end up with wanting to build a Unilever-like business or a very large consumer goods company. And the whole brand aggregator play is actually how we are turbocharging that long-term business model. So in the first couple of years, we're acquiring brands to kickstart their business rather than building from scratch. But at the end of the day, we want to have a very large group that has maybe 30, 40 brands, household names that we can be proud of and change the consumer habits of locals here in Indonesia and also maybe the region. And also along the lines of Unilever, I think we want to build a multi-generation type business. I think that's normally not something you hear in the tech world, but I've been through that businesses, you know, invested in multi different startups. So I think for us, we want to do something that's a bit more long-term. We've always taught by Ali, taught by a lot of the Chinese players, DT, etc. Like, if you don't build a 10-year business, there's no point. We always set that as our initial goal, to build a very long-term business. And I think generational one seems to make sense, because consumer goods is something that we can continue long-term versus some of these more fad-ish or very seasonal type of tech or even D2C businesses. And that also draws a lot of parallel with Unilever. We do a lot of products that are a lot more day-to-day, very daily use case, and very long product life cycle. So whatever we build today, unlike, say, fashion products, we don't need to keep changing or that sun constantly. We look at like about 15, 18 month life cycle versus 3 or 4 months. So it gives us time to grow the market, grow the brands, etc.
So we've talked about now a couple of times the common areas in which a team of experts, which you obviously have put together at Jufu to accomplish this, some of the things we can do. We can help the small company with product development, moving into new markets, optimizing digital ad spend, etc. These all sound wonderful conceptually, but in reality, what are the one or two problems that you are most commonly solving for the SME merchants that you acquire and invest in?
Yeah, it always sounds great on the outside, but when you actually do the work, we all know that's something, a very different perspective. But I think a lot of us entrepreneurs or those who have launched a business from zero, we don't look at it as a problem, right? We just look at the process. So I think first of all, we need to have that mental state to go into any type of business. You're going to face problems, man. That's for sure. Let's not treat it as just a problem. It's just a process. So let's look at it from that perspective. But for a lot of, call it SMEs, not just Indonesia, but in the region, I think one of the biggest problems today is access to some sort of financing. I think it's very common because I would say anywhere, maybe in Singapore even, we don't have a lot of very good financial products like in the US or Europe to support a lot of these newer businesses. So that's a big problem. And that financing as well is not very matured here in the region, except for P2P, but that's very expensive. So it eats into the bottom line. That's a big problem that we're trying to solve. So we, as a group, are able to work with certain financial institutions to de-risk a lot of these businesses. So as a group, instead of one business having $5 million of revenue, we go in there with $50 million and say, hey, financial institute, can we get something better than what's out there in the market? And we go in with that group mentality. So that's one. And two, that's very problematic, is being traditional business owners. When I say traditional, I think it covers about 98% on entrepreneurs in Southeast Asia. They are very traditional. They never work in a professional day, not in some tech companies. And a lot of VCs say they're not blue chip founders. So I still find that very varied. But basically, they can't hire, say, someone from BCG, McKinsey, or someone from, say, Unilever even. They'll find it hard, one, building out a job description even for them. And second is managing them over long-term and retaining them. Fortunately, we've got the experience in doing that. And we have a very different colleague culture. Attracts a lot of these high-caliber folks that build scale businesses, professional folks. Yeah, we are able to attract the talent and maintain them to help these brands to scale up. And I think that's the challenge, because a lot of them reach that glass ceiling and they can't iterate because they do not use data. They use a gut feeling. And today in the marketplaces, there's so much competition from the locals, and even a lot of Chinese and Indian entrepreneurs are setting up shop in this region. And those markets are, call it maybe 2 to 5 years more mature than us in certain categories. So I think that's one additional challenge that previously they would have faced. So I think that's why we know how to tackle these issues. I wouldn't say we're perfect. I'm going to just put a caveat there, but at least we have the team, the processes, the frameworks to help them grow sustainably in the long term.
Yeah, going back to the very beginning of your answer, I like the modus operandi or MO, think process, not problem. That definitely lends itself, I think, to that longer term planning. Now, you also just talked about assisting these small merchants with funding. This business, I assume, indeed requires a lot of capital to continue acquiring and integrating. And I assume you don't want to do a lot of dilutive equity raising. So how exactly does this work?
If you asked me this question pre-COVID, it would be a very different answer. But of course, today, the fundraising scene has changed tremendously. So I think today we are a lot more conservative in approach to growth, to acquisitions, partnerships, etc. I think that's very clear. There's no more, call it a money burning kind of mode versus before. I think at Grab, I probably invested maybe $250 million in marketing in my tenure there. But today here, we have to just look at very sustainable, profitable growth. All our brands are profitable. I think that's one very important thing to note. And as a group as well, we are profitable. And I think that comes from my Grab days where it's always in the red, in the balance sheet. So I think today, seeing positive profitability is such a life-changing experience for me. So I think that's very good. For the next couple of years, we'll be a lot more realistic, more grounded type of valuations to the brands that we work with. And also, I think that allows us to be realistic with investors as well. And being profitable, I think there's two other benefits. One is we're able to raise a lot of debt. That previously, I think if you're a high-burn type of company, banks won't look at you. So here we have positive EBITDA. So we are able to go to banks, go to certain institutions and raise some kind of debt from them for both acquisition and also operating capital. And the other one is, I think once we reach to what we call a certain critical mass, we can just invest off the balance sheet. And if you have maybe say $8 to $10 million of profitability annually. That's maybe 2-3 medium or one large size company that we could bring on board on an annual basis. So I think if we just show good judgment in investments, good strategy, long-term and proven track records in growth, we don't see an issue whether we want to raise or not in terms of capital. But you're right, it's just whether how much and dilute or what's the valuation we're looking at. I think gone are the days where we would raise every, call it maybe 6 to 9 months. I think now we're looking more at an 18 to 24 month horizon for fundraising. So give it a bit more time to grow before you go and fundraise so that you don't dilute too much. That's something we're looking to do.
Now, what types of investors find a natural fit in what we're doing at Juful?
Again, a good question. Nowadays, the investors, whether they are venture capital, private equity, growth funds, or family offices, I think they're all figuring out how to invest and also how to restructure their portfolio. But for us, we see a lot of investors that are interested in us with that are more consumer focused or more product, physical products, not just tech products, but physical products. I think those are always on the lookout for folks like us. But also, I think the other ones that we've been speaking with, a lot of strategic investors where they have sort of interest in growing a consumer business or leveraging our distribution channel to sort of synergize with their existing businesses. So we do have a couple of interested parties that are working with us to think through that better. Again, the fundraising scene has changed. It's not just money going in or capital going in, but there must be a much stronger thesis. And I think being in Indonesia, which is the fourth most populous country in the world, a lot of global players are interested to enter the market. And consumer, I think, is something that we all are very interested in. So if anyone's fundraising, I think, go to global markets and see what's happening there. I think you'll be surprised at how valuable Indonesia has become over the last, call it, 2 to 3 years.
That is great to hear. The last time I was systematically going out to investors was with the Sea Limited Roadshow. And most of my compatriots here in the United States couldn't even find Indonesia on a map. So it sounds like we've come a long way there. And very interesting pedigree of investor that you've just brought up, being more focused on physical goods, consumer products, et cetera. Now, I wanted to ask you, do any of the entrepreneurs or leadership teams that you acquire or invest in end up joining the actual Juful leadership team?
I love that question. That's actually at the core of what we do. We want to upskill these brand owners. Maybe just a tiny bit of background or context about a lot of these brand owners. What we see these brand owners as mainly, they are not so much, call it your modern day CEO. They are not versed in the general management of business. A lot of them are more CPOs, chief product officers, if you ask me. They're very good at identifying what to bring to the market and who to target. But in the, call it like the general running of the business, they do lack that experience, and that's fine. A lot of times right now at Juful, we get brand owners to work under brand owners to figure out certain new product launches, community to target, etc. It's not a formal role that we put them in right now, but informally, they're already naturally, organically doing these sort of value add to each other. But we do believe that over time, once we get more matured, we get better at what we do, then we're able to put them up to the group level and give them a much bigger sort of sandbox or playground to help them fail and learn quickly versus just in their one category. We hope to do that in the very near future.
I have to say, I like the image of a kind of a cross-pollination that can occur amongst your acquired teams. Now, from a financial perspective, Juful is trying to invest in or purchase outright online brands and then add significant value. We've established that. But hasn't the ability to buy teams or products relatively inexpensively already been arbitraged out of the system with the rise of many competing brand aggregators? I know there are almost like bulletin boards which offer pricing of each type of asset. So is it at all possible to find reasonable valuations, or is that no longer really part of our value add?
Oh, wow. That sounds like a very investor type question, but I like it. So I've got the sort of FAQ version of answering that, but let me just give you a bit of fun fact before we go to the details. If you look at the typical VC model, I think, call it Southeast Asia. You look at the top guys. I think when it comes to dry powder, you look at the Vertexes, the ACVs, and partners of these. I think there's probably about $2 billion worth of dry powder. And easily, I think 2B is probably understating. And they typically now invest a lot into more very tech-driven, high-growth companies. And they've given up their thesis onto D2C, a lot of them. That's what I've seen. Maybe you have other news, and I'll be happy to hear that. And then if you look at the brand aggregator model, I think in the region, there's only a handful of us. And comparing dry powder to dry powder, I think we only have maybe, call it somewhere in the range of $100 million. So $100 million versus $2 billion, you can see that gap. For me, I wish there were more competitors in the brand aggregator space, because I don't think there's enough of us to really scale up D2Cs in the level like in the US or Europe. Still quite far off, and VCs, I don't think they're going to heavily invest in D2Cs. D2Cs might have to go to more traditional routes, whether it's going to the families to borrow money or go to banks. So I think dry powder, you can see it's a huge gap. And then I think arbitraging-wise, we're very different versus other aggregators. We don't go in there to just buy someone out. We rarely do. 90% of our investments go into primary. So we work with brand owners. So we partner with them and do a lot of value add. And so far, our portfolio over the last 1 year has grown over 70% year on year. So I think even if we buy at, call it maybe 8-9x EBITDA, actually we buy a lot lower. And we do say over the next 5 years, we grow the businesses 500 to 600%. I think the value add speaks for itself versus what arbitrage number that exists in the market. That's what investors see in us. It's not 50x for sure, but at least 8 to 10x growth in the next couple of years is very, call it conservative and doable from my eyes. And thanks to the market as well, consumer products, consumer behavior is continuously on the positive side, especially the categories we invest in, which are a bit more daily use case versus the more fan-ish or seasonal categories.
Point of clarification, D2C, which you've been mentioning a number of times, TJ, stands for direct to consumer, which really describes the way these stores basically sell to the consumer. So what do you consider the ideal target company? For instance, what platforms do they sell on? What categories in your mind are ideal? What parts of their, if you will, corporate anatomy are they lacking that we can assist them with? And for instance, is geographical coverage an important criterion? What comprises the ideal target company?
All the questions you're asking are the questions we ask every day internally. You coming from that kind of background, investing and looking at markets, I think you asked the right question here. And I think for us, we look to productize this entire sort of acquisition process. So we have close to 50 criteria that we look at for a company. And so it's like just plugging in the numbers or certain qualitative analysis. And then from there, we'll come up with a score and decide whether it makes sense for us. But the high level criteria we want is that the brand needs to be in the category that we want to invest in. That's one. And now we're investing into four categories. One is FMCG consumables. Two is home and living. Three, consumer electronics. And number four is health and fitness. So these are the four large categories. And then from there, we'll figure out the subcategories. Another big component is the business needs to be EBITDA positive. It needs to be profitable. Or if in very rare cases, we look at businesses that are not profitable, but if they do show signs of being able to profitable, then we would consider them. But most of the time, if you're running a, call it managed direct-to-consumer brand, you should be profitable. You don't need to burn money, I think. So that's a very big criteria. And three, of course, we need to look at the culture fit. How does the team, our team, so our process, we never say, hey, we're the fastest term sheet in town. We're probably the slowest. So we do a lot of diligence with the other party because we are going to work together. It's a marriage, not a sort of buyout most of the time. So we do take a bit more work early on and get to know each other much better before we proceed with our term sheet or the next steps to investment. Three very important points worth there.
Very clear. Now, I believe Jufu has acquired at least five brands so far. Could you tell us briefly about one of these brands?
Sure. So the brands that we brought on board, a couple of them were called legacy brands in Indonesia. We have Dapur Chocolate, which is FMCG consumable type of business. It's a 22-year-old business in Indonesia. Yeah. And they did very well. Even during COVID, they continued to expand. So now they sell mainly from their own stores. So they're about 70 retail outlets. And so from there, we bring in the expertise, helping them to increase their distribution channels. We bring their products to other more common, like modern trade, general trade type of channels. So we increase their distribution. So it's not just to their 70 stores. We can bring them into that 40, 50,000 store network that we already have with, call it like your Indomaret, Alfamart, Ranch Farmer, Food Hall, Grand Lucky, and other general trade stores in Indonesia. We always find very clear synergies with the brands that we bring on board so that 70-100% year-on-year growth is always very prominent in the first couple of years.
Cool. Now, TJ, you've already told us about the criteria you apply in looking for potential investee merchants. I guess that leads to the question, do you therefore compete with the venture capital funds in investing in your companies?
A couple of years ago, it probably would seem like that because VCs are doing a lot of D2C type investments. I think recently, we don't really see that. A lot of the brands that we speak to, they don't get VC type of term sheets. Of course, various reasons, but I think the main reason is because there are businesses that are not highly scalable. They're not 50X type of businesses. We don't directly compete with a lot of VCs. Maybe one or two VC, D2C VC funds that we might run into sometimes, but actually we share a lot of deals if you ask me. So it's sort of very friendly out there. If you look at the entire SME or D2C space in Indonesia alone, there's probably 20, 30,000 brands that we actually could work with. It's a massive pie that we all can share. We don't compete directly. Actually, we come across more conglomerate type of competition, funny enough. So a lot of Indonesian conglomerates are very keen to buy out some of these brands. And we actually come across a lot of conglomerates that are competing with us to buy some of the brands that we brought on board or even some prospective ones. It's a very different landscape, actually. If you ask me, it's not just purely VC. There's a lot of other components or I'll call it stakeholders here.
From what you mentioned earlier, TJ, it sounds as though you commonly invest in companies that are predominantly offline and, among other things, try to bring them online. If that's correct, isn't that extremely time-consuming and resource-consuming?
If we look at and draw parallels with larger brands from Indonesia, you can compare with Wings, compare with the indoor foods of Indonesia. When you look at the businesses, they are probably 97% revenue generating from offline. And if you look at Indonesia as a whole, a lot of studies show that only 7%, 8% maximum of retail is done online. So majority of sales are still done offline, believe it or not. I think that shows the potential of e-commerce, but also there's a lot of challenges. Through your experience, you probably know the challenges of selling online in Indonesia. So for us, we took that long-term view from day one. How can we build, not call it $10 million business, but how can we build a $100 million business for each brand? To do that, we need to have offline as well as online, so an omni-channel type of approach. So for us, when we work with offline brands, they have a lot of existing distribution channels offline as well. So for example, with one of our other brands called Cypress, it's a kitchen and cookware brand. It's 15 years in the market and they distribute to almost 1,000 offline stores, including modern trade and general trade. So when we partnered with them, we also acquired their offline distribution channel and hence we're able to cross-sell products into those offline channels. Yes, I think bringing an offline brand online is challenging. It's in its own right. But also at the same time, we benefit from some of the existing infrastructure they've already built. Again, I don't see it as a challenge. I don't see it as a problem. I just see it as a process. And ultimately, if the long-term goal is to build $100 million brands and not $5 million or $10 million brands, then we need to do that work from now. We can't take the easy way out. We need to face that challenge upfront.
Now, How do the online e-commerce platforms in Indonesia, such as Tokopedia, TikTok Shop, Lazada, Shopee, Blibli, Bukalapak, and others view us? Do we intend to build a marketplace of D2C brands to compete with them?
Realistically, back to our business model, we are more consumer goods, we are household brands. We are not going to build a marketplace platform and do all sell all type of model. No, for us, we are very focused on building the brand equity, building the distribution channel. So when we work with your typical e-com marketplaces, we view them as a channel. We always will work with them and leverage whatever they have, their consumer base, their advertising providers, etc. So I think we'll always work with them as a channel. And the reality is they will always outspend us. And that's fine. For us, we view them as more of an acquisition channel. And if we do set up our own stores online with Shopify or our own channels, it's more for a bit more retention, getting data to understand our consumers versus competing at acquisition level, like the larger marketplaces.
Understood. Now, TJ, a number of our peers, particularly the large e-commerce acquirers or roll-up plays in the West, such as Thrasio and Benetago, have filed for bankruptcy. What did they do wrong that we can avoid? What does this mean for the future of Jufu?
That's a tough one to answer. I think because, of course, it's very close to the heart. It's a very similar business model. And I really looked up to Thrasio in the early days. We studied them a lot. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, about maybe in 2021 and 2022, they expanded very quickly, right, into China. And they also were looking to expand to India. And I think that's when they hit a bit of funding issues as well because of the market. And also interest rates have been going up. They leverage a lot of debt. So I think two issues there. One is overexpansion. And I think they couldn't synergize a lot of the brands that they brought on board because they were acquiring really small brands and huge spectrum in terms of category, from cleaners to fashion to basically anything that looks good on Amazon. I don't think they could have extracted the full synergies of the entire portfolio, which was maybe close to 1,000 brands, a lot of brands that they put on board. And of course, I think don't over-leverage the business. In the US, the AA short is they're able to raise debt at a 1-to-3 ratio, $1 of equity to $3 of debt. So that's why you can see they raise like billions of dollars, but majority of it is debt financing. So if interest rates go up, the business are not doing well and they can't repay a lot of the business, their debt. And I think you can see where we're going here. So I think for Southeast Asia, we just need to ensure that we don't over leverage, I think, which we can't, because a lot of banks here and financially are super conservative. So I think that's a good thing for us. But at the same time, I think it would be great to have a bit more somewhere in the middle, I think would be great for the ecosystem. So yeah, I think those two very critical points that sort of impacted some of these other more global aggregators.
Yeah, I remember coverage of how incredibly aggressive they became. And I can imagine it being very difficult to keep things together, growing at such an exponential scale. So, TJ, what have been some of the most fascinating areas in which Indonesia's merchants have evolved in your mind over, say, the past 5 years?
If you go back to, say, 2016, 2017, when Tokopedia, Shopee, everyone was just starting to grow. And then there was, of course, the Lazada's, Bukalapak. So I think a lot of the merchants, when they started going online, was very digitizing their businesses. It was a very different concept. They were more old school traditional business saying, hey, let's digitize, let's go online. Now, I think post e-commerce marketplaces, a lot of brands started online and they've stayed online. They haven't really penetrated offline as much. But if you look at a lot of global D2Cs, especially like in the US and Europe, they've already matured to a point where they are very omni-channel. So they don't just do online. They also had to go offline because they reached a saturation point online. So I think for merchants, what we see is the traditional ones that started offline are continuing to thrive today because they have a strong offline component, or they know offline. Whereas those who are online, they face a lot of stagnation in the business. because competition, e-com marketplaces are not growing. I think if you take Tokopedia and Shopee, if you look at their first half last year, 22 versus 23, I think the GMV actually had a downward trend. I think they were negative maybe 4%. So I think you can see if you're just purely investing online, it's going to be a tough one. It's getting more and more expensive to invest online, like Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. It's not getting cheaper. If you look at marketplaces, their revenue share is also increasing. I still remember Tokopedia 2% and now it's 5-7%. I think Shopee is going into double digits as well next year for a lot of merchants. Basically, cost of service is getting higher, cost of acquisition getting higher online. If a brand is happy to make, say, a couple of $100,000 of profits a year, then sticking online is fine. It works. But if you want to become a national brand, you want $100 million business, you can't do it online alone in Indonesia. You have to go offline as well. Fortunately, unfortunately. Yeah, I think if you have these really data-driven founders, very tech-savvy, and you put them with a more traditional street smart founder, I think that's the best of both worlds today.
Fascinating how you call into question something I think became a default assumption, which is the invincibility and the all-enabling nature of going online. We're now at a point where actually a lot of the next several yards to the try line or the goal line involves more effective penetration offline. So that's refreshing to hear. DJ, I can't let you off the hook with at least one interesting observation about the recently announced TikTok investment in Tokopedia. We all know the headlines here, but one or two thoughts that maybe may not be entirely apparent that you're thinking about?
For us, as call-in brand owners, we welcome any channel, like especially those who want to invest heavily. Maybe just a bit of how we viewed TikTok before they got shut down here, and then maybe going to TikTok and Tokopedia. So before, a lot of the brands that we see and the brands that we have on board, TikTok was a great channel for us to sell on. And when they closed, we thought, hey, traffic sales from TikTok would 100% shift over to the other marketplaces, your Tokopedia and Shopee. But we actually only saw a very tiny uplift in revenue in the other channels, non-TikTok channels. So call it like 8 to 10% growth, which is weird. You would think that buying habits, it's just a channel. People will just shift from one side to another, but it didn't. So it just goes to show how different, right, the consumers were on TikTok, whether they were more impulse buyers, they had a much more engaging live commerce platform. So I think TikTok coming back and working together with Tokopedia, I think that's a great partnership. And I do think it's good for a lot of SMEs, good for a lot of local sellers in Indonesia. And what better day to ask this question than today, which is we're shooting on 12-12, right? So it's a massive double date and it's the last one of the year. So I do think that this new partnership would be very beneficial. Of course, we've seen a lot of, call it mergers that did well and also not so well over time. I'm giving our opinion here, but as a user of TikTok and our brands and Tokopedia, we don't really have information yet on how the merger is going to affect us. A lot of theories are being developed in our teams and also different information are coming in. But at the moment, I think we're still wait and see. But if you really think of what Tokopedia has, its massive consumer base and a deeply engaging one with certain categories, which are a bit more upper segment, and TikTok being a bit more mass. I think it's a great marriage. It's like you get that mass premium category and then you get the middle and the mass segment. I think putting those two together, this is one of the few maybe e-commerce platform that can really think they cover the whole of the Indonesia spectrum in terms of population and consumer segment. Potentially, it could mean that, which is great. And hopefully they don't just overcharge us and on fees, advertising, etc.
Very interesting that your findings that you referenced imply that what TikTok Shop was doing, this social or short video-based commerce, was unique and maybe even incremental to what the purely e-commerce-oriented platforms like Lazada, Shopee, Tokopedia were doing, to the extent that the GMV that TikTok Shop lost when it was shut down did not go to these other guys. Testimony to how e-commerce is constantly evolving. TJ, you guys at Jufu are clearly in a super dynamic space. The brand aggregator model is clearly so multifaceted, and bringing a small merchant to a new growth trajectory sounds super complex, whether it's assisting with their fundraising or their headcount expansion needs that you mentioned earlier. But it's obviously very rewarding. Thanks a bunch for joining us today.
Thanks again, Alan, for having me and Jufu here. Always open to discussing more on consumer and Indonesia. So hopefully come back one day with something more interesting and add some kind of value to the listeners. So thank you very much, Alan, and the team over there at Indotechno.
You're very welcome. We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's episode. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indotechno podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.